Let's begin. May you please introduce yourself, both of you?
So my name is Sam Awad. I'm a Palestinian who lives in Bethlehem, and I'm the founder of an organization called Holy Land Trust, which is an organization that is committed to peace, justice, and equality in the Holy Land, and bringing Palestinians and Israelis together to address the core issues of the conflict and to create together a new vision for peace in the Holy Land.
My name is Barbara Wegmüller. I live here in Bern, in Switzerland, and I am a Zen teacher, and I belong to the organization of Zen Peacemakers International, a group of people who bring meditation together and social action. So we bring our actions out of the meditation room.
How it is for you, Sami, to be such an engaged peacemaker in one of the most conflictful regions on world? And then also, how is it for Barbara being such an active peacemaker in one of the most peaceful countries in the world?
For me, at one point, I want to say I did not have a choice to be a peacemaker or not. I grew up in a conflict area. I saw violence happening every day of my life. I lived under occupation. I saw the injustice all the time. At the same time, I grew up in a family that was always committed to peace work. From the time my father's family became refugees in 1948, when they lost their father and they were kicked out from their home, my grandmother always insisted that her family will always seek peace and reconciliation with those who did this to us. So the seed of being peacemakers was always present in our family. But at a very young age, I was personally influenced by an uncle of mine. His name is Mubarak. And my uncle Mubarak was a leader in the nonviolent movement. And at the age of 12, I participated in the first nonviolent action with him, which was planting olive trees in a land that was going to be confiscated by Israeli Jewish settlers from a Palestinian farmer. And that was a very empowering activity for me. I felt for the first time I can do something to address the occupation and being nonviolent about it. And that began the discourse of my life, to commit my life to being a peacemaker in a situation where it is not easy at all. I mean, there is violence and there is hatred and fear all the time. But I think when we are called to something, we do it.
Wow. Very touching, Sami. And I know you since long as a very warm and good friend, so I'm honored to be with you and call you my friend. Of course, it's very different for me to live here. So I grew up in a loving, very politically active family. My father was a socialist. He was very spiritual. It was very important for him to have ethics, an ethic ground. And he was also an advocate. So very early I heard from him that right is not justice. And the suffering of the world was a theme also on our dining table. So it was really very early. I had a deep experience when I was around, I would say, 6 or 7 years old, when I saw my mother reading the newspapers. She was in front of the newspaper and she was very shaken. And I saw that and stand next by her, and there was this picture of a woman. I saw her from behind. She looked very old, but she had like several children next to her, and she was walking, and the picture was from behind. And I asked my mother, "What is this?" Because my mother was weeping, so it was very touching for me. And then she said, "You know, they sent these people to death." And it was a picture was what I saw later in Auschwitz.
Wow.
And at that moment, I knew that this world is not a safe place. So it was a very deep imprint for me. And the start, of course, of being open, and that I wanted to be the world a safe place, because As a mother, of course, and as a human being, this was my hope that the way the world would be a safe place.
So my name is Bernie, and I'm really glad to be here. It's been a while. How many of you don't know anything about me? Okay, me too.
Sami, do you believe the capitalistic logic of society systems can really change one day, and how?
Well, I actually believe that we are, in a sense, approaching the end of the capitalist patriarchal system of running things. Yeah, I mean, I think capitalism is going to eat itself up at some point. The greed of the few to take control over the masses and over the resources of this land will reach a point where I really believe that nature itself and humanism itself will not allow it to continue. And it's very terrible to see what is happening under the system of capitalism today. And I think it will end. The question is, how will it end? Will it end with a disaster, or will it end with a transformation of our human consciousness to begin to see that there is something beyond what we have now? And for me, I believe that returning to the land, honoring the resources provided to us, the water, the air, the cleanliness of this, and the fruits of the land is the way to go. And for me, it's been really wonderful and an honor for me in the last few years to connect more and more with indigenous communities, that their voice is beginning to raise very high globally in saying that we need to return to the land and listen to the land and honor the land, and we need to begin to think of new ways of living as a species, as the human species on this land.
Yeah, I had the chance to join a Bear and Witness retreat in Pine Ridge with Native people, and it was very, very touching, also their teachings. And it's also my feeling that we have really to acknowledge the sacredness of Mother Earth and to support that in however we can do that, and stop our greed and our needy being to always want more and more, and to see that all species and all human beings have the right to live in peace and in dignity, which is so important.
And how does globalization have influenced the history of humanity to this actuality we live now?
When I think of globalization, we could look at it in both ways. I think the positive and the negative, the ways that have moved us forward and the ways that has pulled us backward. I mean, for the first time in human history, we are so interconnected as humans. We know anything that happens anywhere within seconds. We're able to follow the news. We're able to see things take place. And so I think part of it is that the world has become a smaller place. Our ability to travel anywhere in the world within 20 hours, you are there, is something that is very beautiful and very unique. And so it's a question of how do we take those positive aspects of becoming a global family and this whole issue of connectedness and the information that we are able to share with each other and the resources we're able to share with each other, and at the same time understand that there is a certain aspects of globalization that have become negative, which is environmental, destroying the resources, abuse, the ability of capitalism to move products back and forth in fast ways to destroy the products of Mother Earth, weapons industry, all of this comes with it as well. And so for me, it's like looking at this as a phase of transition of how we can become a global family as humans, and at the same time learn through this oneness to be able to really live in global peace.
Yeah, you could not say it better. I really like what you say. And what I think it's the beautiful thing is really that we can learn from each other. We can learn from the suffering and from the joy of each other. But we also have to care for the whole globe now, and for, of course, for the sea and for the air, and because we breathe all the same air together, so we have to take care and to connect. And that maybe needs also our wisdom to know that we are on one point very responsible for the part where we live, the small Switzerland here, and do our best, and on the other side that we are not, that our country is not really at the border already at the end, but that these borders are only in our heads, and that we really need to connect also for everybody, and that we are responsible also for everybody. We are not so separate as we usually think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important also, like being in Switzerland and seeing the beauty and the richness of Switzerland, also to be fully in the consciousness of also understanding where a lot of this wealth came from. And it did come from countries where colonialists lived, and there was oppression, and there was slavery and trade and destruction of resources. And so part of this movement is how can we repair the relationships with these communities, instead of saying this is the beautiful, no, the world is beautiful. And so how can we really engage in creating this balance between those who now have the resources and those who don't, and understand that a lot of this exchange came from war and violence as well.
Of course, a lot of our richness comes from there, and still does. I mean that we are in such a wonderful situation that we were not part in two world wars. So I think it would be our responsibility that we would not sell parts to make weapons and selling weapons outside. Yeah. And that we are also responsible from where the money comes, and not just like open the arms for everybody who sends the money here to a safe place. So Switzerland would be even much more beautiful, I think, if we would be proud to work on freedom and not only on richness and support wars through our money.
Yeah.
Yes, religion has caused so many wars. How can spirituality help the peace process?
Religion has been very destructive, and I come from a Christian background, and for me it's one of the greatest disappointments when I read statistics, for example, that says more people have been killed on the hands of those who claim to be Christian than all of the other religions combined. You know, today we talk about Muslim violence and the Buddhist violence and all kinds of violence, and we forget how the Christian community globally has caused so much violence in history, more than any other religion. And then for me, it has been a disaster. Living in the Holy Land, I always say there's a lot of religion in the Holy Land, but very little spirituality.
Mm.
And this is why we fight over religion all the time, because when we focus through religion and how we relate to each other, we engage in creating separation. We engage in creating entitlement. We engage in creating a sense of my religion and my faith is better than yours, and therefore I have the right to demonize you and then to destroy you, because my God told me it is okay to do that because I follow the true religion, and it doesn't matter what religion it is. And then for me, returning to spirituality becomes important, because when it comes to spirituality, we are all interconnected. That means we practice maybe different traditions and we practice different rituals, but in our core, spirituality means that we are one with earth, we are one with the spirit, we are one in creation, and we really understand ourselves differently when we practice spirituality. And so for me it's been a journey. How do I move away from religion to spirituality? And for me it's been a joy to do that, and that makes me see the beauty in all other practices and traditions.
Of course, if we are on a path and if we practice, we are one also is all the mystics in all the religions. So this is the basic, I think, from all the grounds. And therefore, if we really practice and if we feel that we have, even in that diversity in the oneness, it's wonderful to practice together, which what I really love. It's so beautiful if we can practice next to each other in different religions also, if we have this openness to enjoy each other and to learn from each other and celebrate that we are human, spiritual human beings. For me, the difference is really that we go deeper and that we open up and that we live with an open heart. I think if we practice and our heart is not opening more and more, and if we practice and still think it's the only way, maybe we have really to practice more in all the religions, because to have with a loving heart and be compassion, I think this is the effect if we really feel that we are spiritual, and we support this way to go.
Yeah, for me, I want to say that, you know, when we met many, many years ago, if in my mind I kept that notion of being a Christian, the relationship would not have lasted. Because for me, to be a Christian and then to be with somebody who's a Zen and Buddhist and practitioner means it's wrong, I shouldn't do that. But when we move into spirituality, then I could sit with you, I could do meditation with you, and I could still be fully embedded in my faith and my tradition without feeling that it is threatened. And if we keep the small mindset of religion, that means I will live in fear all the time. And so in my religion, I live in fear because I don't want to go to hell, for example, and to connect with you, I will live in fear because I don't want you to change me. And so we create more separation.
Yes.
But if spirituality becomes the line that connects us, then there is, like you say, we could celebrate who we are and celebrate with each other, our traditional background, and practice. I become more faithful to my religion, for example, when I do meditation, which the church doesn't do. But I began to understand Jesus and his teachings much more when I did meditation. And then I read, like, oh, he also used to do meditation. But the church doesn't teach us to do that.
Exactly.
Because they wanted to suppress that practice.
Yes.
And so now it creates a big openness for me to learn from other traditions and to bring that into my own tradition as well.
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, but my feeling was very early that this Christ was quite a revolutionary and that his teachings, especially from the Bergpredigt, was really about being open and loving for all. And maybe therefore he was, of course, not so well received by the powerful people.
Of course.
It was not about, his teachings are not about power at all. So, but the churches did a lot about the power then. And I had good luck to meet my Sufi teacher, who was a very open-minded person. And so we studied different mystics from different traditions, which I always loved very much. And also in Zen, I had this kind of really revolutionary, open-minded teacher in Bernie Glassman. So for me, it was always so important to have a big mind and not a small one. Yeah. And so I'm grateful for my teachers very much.
So this is what I see in all religions. We get sort of attached to the form rather than to the essence. For me, Zen is a school of Buddhism. And Buddhism, the word Buddha means to an awakened one. So Buddhism is a school of awakening. Awakening to what? To me, it's awakening to the interconnectedness of life, to the oneness of life.
Why do you think this moment is being such a fertile scenario for radicals and fascist leaders to have power in so many countries?
It is always the same play that is played out. It's always creating fear among people and then creating enemies And the enemies are always the people who are mostly in need. So the people who have to leave wars and poverty. And then the politicians who want the power, they just create fear and tell people that these are the bad ones and they will take them their richness away. They want to take them the places of work away. It's always the same, very, very simple game and creating fear and people just buy it. It's too sad. Everybody wants to have a black sheep or an enemy where they can put all their shadows on it. And this simple system works again and again. It's really tragic to see. And all these right-wing fascist political, they just choose it. And they create for themselves the role model of person who can solve all the problem of the world, but it's not so simple. And they always design this simple answer that people who do not really go deeper with the question and not allow themselves also to feel the fear more that it is not so simple and that we should maybe work a little bit harder together and go in discussion even with people who seem not to be the same, so they don't do that, and so it's very easy then to jump on this path with all these crazy leaders that we have now.
Yeah.
It doesn't look nice at all.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, one quote that is sort of become a mantra for me when it comes to this issue is that fear is the greatest motivator of human behavior. And when people are afraid, they will do anything to protect themselves. And so the illusion of fear is fear as well. So you cannot tell somebody it's an illusion. When people are afraid, they're afraid. Just like, you know, when our children are afraid that there's a monster under the bed,
there
we cannot tell them there isn't a monster, go to sleep. But in their mind and their perceptions, they are afraid.
Yeah.
And so we have to address this fear. And then sadly, like you say, the leaders today are using fear all the time to motivate their people in the decisions that they want their people to choose, which is only giving more power to those who are in power already. Because if you are afraid and I have power, then you will surrender even more power to me to protect you and to take care of you. And I think part of also what the system that we live under today has created also a system where there is very little ability to know what is really going on, because they also control the information resources, they control the media, they control the school education, they control our ability to communicate with each other. So knowledge, which is very important, becomes very little. You have to find out, like really, you have to really research. If you really want to know what's happening in Africa or in the Middle East, you really have to research beyond what the news agencies tell us, because this is also part of the control mechanism that they have. So if you control power and you control information and knowledge, this is the challenge.
It's a dangerous thing, yes. And of course it feels also very overwhelming if we hear about all the struggles and challenges around the world. So, of course, it's really not easy, and we have to teach that it's not easy, but that we have to do some homework and really go deeper in the studies and see what happens.
Yeah, a lot of distractions that they give us. I also wanted to say that I think a big part of it is our human consciousness has not evolved yet to the point where we begin to understand the insanity of what you said, repeating it. And to understand, like, no fascist system has ever lasted. No dictatorship has ever lasted. No empire has ever lasted. And all these leaders and all these countries actually think that they are going to maintain these countries forever by doing what they do. And ultimately, all of this is going to collapse. I mean, sure, it will collapse. The Roman Empire that thought it will last forever collapsed.
Yeah.
And all these empires collapse. And so we need to raise this consciousness of saying, yeah, we need to get out of these illusions, out of these fears, and to really begin to move into new spaces.
Considering these upcoming leaders, do you still believe in democracy, or you think something has to change in the political systems?
I believe on democracy. I mean, here in Switzerland, we have the direct democracy. I believe on it, but I also see here the danger that rich people buy the journals and the information, control the information flow. And they have a lot of effects, of course, also on our whole population. And so education, I would put on top of the list, really education, also political education in schools from different sides, of course, like just showing where we go and learning about history, especially what happened, speaking also about what trauma does to us, because we are a traumatized civilization, I think. So we have all these wars and fights in ourselves, and we have really to learn about how we deal with our fears, that we share also our hopes and visions, that we really start to teach the children and to create places where vision has a place, where we can enjoy and where we can find common wish, just to be happy beings with a healthy nature and with healthy mere, with healthy oceans and with many, many living beings, and do our best to support that and give our young people also hope, and our children's hope that they can do it, and that we want to support them. I think this is very important in all this disaster also to sustain this hope and to support it.
Yeah, I mean, they say democracy is the best of all the terrible systems,
yes,
that are out there. And then for me, it becomes easier than to accept democracy because everything else is terrible. But I think also, like you, I mean, I don't know, in Switzerland maybe there's a unique approach to it, but I see how it is played out globally. And democracy, I think, has become a failed system of governance and of getting consensus and of creating a space where all rights are protected for all the peoples and all creatures. In the United States, for example, or in the Middle East, or any country that claims to be a democracy, we are also using fear to gain power.
Yes.
And we gain power through fear. So what is the difference between democracy and dictatorship when the drive is fear? What Trump is doing, what Netanyahu is doing, what anybody's doing, they are using fear of the other, mm-hmm, to gain power. And then they just want to maintain power by keeping fear alive more and more. And yes, you could say, okay, every 4 years it changes, but the others are using fear as well. So it doesn't matter even if it's left or right. Both sides, in a sense, are using fear of the other to maintain power. And there is... I think ultimately this system has to be restructured in a way where we create that space where there is more consensus, more engagement. I love circle work, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what we do in this work. How can we create, like my image always of the best system is circles among circles among circles among circles, and they're all interacting and connecting,
mm-hmm,
with each other, where the decisions that are needed for the entire nation are really made by all the people ultimately that goes up in these circle structures. And that most of the decisions, I think, where we are moving in our humanity, even the concept of the nation state, I think, is also reaching its peak, where things will become even more decentralized, where my life, for example, now is around my city. There is more that you are engaging in, for example, living in Bern, than Switzerland. Your social life, your economic life, your taxes, your healthcare, it's all provided more in the structures of the city. So I think where we will shift if we remain in this planet, is more decentralized, more formed around cities and communities. And people even maybe moving out of the cities back to nature, back to communities, and creating models where the child's voice is as important as the adult's voice when it comes to the decisions for that community.
How can minorities organize and empower themselves against oppression and for their rights?
It's so hard when you now think on what happens at the Amazon and with all these native communities. I think the only chance is really also there that they create healthy communities from the very small community of family to the bigger families, to bigger communities in villages and cities, and that they learn, that they are educated also. Education is so important for them. And that they, of course, get the support also from the bigger world, from the whole world, so that they are able to communicate. I think learning about communication is so important. This is a chance of our time that we hear at least about. I mean, there were times where witches were burned and very sad things, a lot of killing happened, and only the people who just lived around knew it. And today we know it. It's completely overwhelming for us, of course. On the other hand, we can try to make pressure on the governments from outside and connect to the people and go and support them also. But it's a long way to go, and it especially with the wish that it will be non-violent, it will always have a lot of victims. We know that from history, it it costs a lot of victims.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's to think of any minority that lives in any country that is being suppressed, how can they have a voice? It's very, very difficult, very challenging, especially as we said before, those who hold power and those who hold information are always presenting these minorities as a threat. And if one person from that minority group commits an act of violence, then that becomes a representation of the entire community.
Yes.
But if one person from the majority commits an act of violence, then it's just this one individual, and you know, he's psychologically disturbed, it's fine, but we are not. We're not like this.
Yes.
That's part of the demonizing that happens. So I think it's very, very challenging. But I agree. I mean, minorities have to have their voice heard, they have to speak up, and they have to resist oppression and inequality and marginalization, and do it through nonviolence, and enroll others to support them, to speak on their behalf. Many minorities don't have a voice. They're afraid to speak. And so it takes those who are aware, those who are conscious, within the group of the majority to begin to speak on their behalf and also to stand with them in the resistance as well. But it's very difficult.
It's very hard.
Very, very challenging.
And of course, we should all work to give them a platform.
Exactly.
So that they have a voice, that they can let us hear what they want to say. Because of a lot of pressure, political pressure, of course, we see that our governments don't want to give to certain people a platform. So when we have people from the government coming from China, they even did the small Tibetan women's in the prison here because they had like a flag, a Tibetan flag. It was such a shame.
Wow.
I mean, it's incredible. So, and of course, this is all about the money and all about rolling out the red tuppies for the carpets for the powerful people.
I guess
too sad.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the question is, do we wait for these systems to collapse and new systems to emerge? Do we begin to create maybe the new ideas, the new visions of new systems where all these voices begin to be heard, even within the system that we are living under, to create sort of the alternative ways where the voices of minorities can be heard maybe if not at the political level, at least at the social level, with social engagement, using art, using music, using theater, using different approaches where people begin to see the beauty of what these minorities, and maybe not always trying to challenge the system itself, because it's going to collapse anyway, so we create the alternatives already.
It's much more beautiful, and I think also much more creative to start there, and that we can do.
Yeah, sure.
We have to do what we can do.
You will.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
Do you think there are different roles for women and men in the peacemaking path?
I'm not so sure anymore. Because the women and the men I know, I think they are all able to feel their both parts in them, also the masculine and the feminine part. And this is a beautiful growing up, I think. It's really a wonderful way also, and the effect of doing spiritual practice, in fact, also. So what I see is just a wonderful sharing. And it is my hope also that we will even grow up in that, in this.
I mean, I agree, these are the people we know.
Yes.
The question is the people we don't know.
But the question was about the people in peacemaking, so I think, there is hope.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, to empower women to have a voice is very crucial and very important. Mm. I always say that one of the reasons why the peace process failed between Palestinians and Israelis is because the voice of women, the feminine voice, not just the voice of women, the feminine voice was completely marginalized by the patriarchal masculine voice. Mm-hmm. Women who were very much involved in building society, building community, resisting the occupation, Palestinian women during the first uprising, for example, who were the leaders who understood a real vision of peace. Mm-hmm. When the peace process began by the men, they were told, step aside. You've done your work, now it is men who will do the peace, and it failed. And so for me, yes, I think we need to bring that balanced voice back. It's not about moving, you know, from masculine to feminine and back and forth. It's about the balance that we need to create between the masculine and the feminine.
Yeah.
And that means, in a sense, again, we have to look at this and say building new ways of how societies function.
Yeah.
The systems we have today, capitalism for me is a pure masculine system. It's patriarchy.
Sure.
And so part of it is to say that, it's not about a woman being president, because a woman can be fully masculine and be president. But it's about a new system where all of this becomes shared together.
Yes, sharing together is a point, I think.
Yeah.
And going out of this competition, of course, which I see in both genders, of course. So it's really that it is our common planet that we are now caring for and that we have to care for, that humanity can survive on this beautiful planet.
Yeah, I love how indigenous communities refer to Earth as mother.
Yes.
As her, as she. And in all my contacts with these indigenous communities, the only thing they teach is we just need to learn to listen to her. She has all the wisdom to teach us even how to live our life. And to see these very strong men who come from these indigenous communities, just listen to mother, listen to her. She has everything, all the wisdom is there. This is so beautiful and so profound. And so again, it's the balance between the masculine energies, which is the political power, and the feminine energies, which is connected to the land, connected to the water, connected to Earth itself, and create this balance.
This was there in Taoism also. It was all there already, and it was there in all times, and we have just to learn and to listen again. And listening is one of the very important words in it, of course.
Yeah.
So that we have to learn to listen to the voices, the cries of, and the wishes of the world.
Do you think human rights and environment someday can be the absolute reference for politics in the world?
Human rights and the environment. The quick answer is yes. I believe that human rights, equal rights, civil rights, environmental rights are going to be the wave of the future. Because in a sense, we cannot sustain ourselves as a species on this planet if we don't address these issues together and create systems where these issues are addressed. And so for me, caring about the environment and caring about the resources, and especially water, which is becoming such a destroyed resource on this planet. If we don't do this, we will not even exist in our future. And so, I would say a big part of my journey has actually been to move from, as a Palestinian even, to say that we need to move from political rights to human rights, civil rights, and environmental rights, and equal rights as the key foundation for the next phase. I don't need to have a state as a Palestinian to survive. I need to have a relationship with the land and a relationship with other human beings that respect me and honor me and respect my rights to live in the land itself. I could have a state, but that state can be completely suppressed by the outside if there is no trust and respect between us. And it's just about power dynamics. So yes, for me, to really connect deeper with the environment, even going to the botanical garden today and and really feeling just the energy of the plants there, like just walking there and like really, like, you know, they speak to us in a way. I mean, not maybe in our ears, but there's a way of communication that we need to relearn. And yeah, for me, it becomes very important. This is the future. For our survival, it's not about political nation-state rights or economic power rights. Yes. Human rights and environmental rights is the future.
For sure. And in a way, I was always sure that we can't own like the earth. This is an illusion. And we are just travelers in a very short time in our lifetimes, and that we really have to care for our children and the next generations.
Yeah. One of the projects we're doing now is Palestinians and Israelis are always fighting each other over the political rights. But one approach where we now find them that they're able to come together and work is when it comes to issues like environmental justice, because the environment does not have borders. The environment is for everybody. And if it's destroyed, everybody suffers from it.
Yes.
And so bringing Israelis and Palestinians to talk about environmental justice creates the relationship between them that then they can begin to talk about human rights and political rights from a different lens than the fighting each other for these rights.
Yeah, to bring us really to the reality that it is all about that and not about our minds who create ideas like having wars about the water or buying the sources of the water, things like that. I mean, creating weapons to defend our rights to own it. This is so sick. So we have really to work from the other side that we can feel it's all belongs to all.
Yeah, it's one like
or to no one.
The statement: we're the only species that has to earn a living to live on this planet. This is the insanity of it.
I mean, yes,
humans can't. You have to buy everything. Again, the system that was created.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have water, you have to buy water. You cannot have food, you have to buy food.
Yeah.
And you have to work for the system so that it gives you the money in order to do that.
Yeah.
And again, like what we were saying earlier, like how long will this last? It cannot last.
No, it cannot go on like that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and how do you think we can convince governments to stop investments in war and destruction, to direct them to peace and healing from suffering and injustice?
not so easy as we see. Especially certain ones. So, oh my, yeah, all these illusions.
Yeah, when we talk about nonviolence, one of the main core aspects of nonviolent activism is pulling power away from those who hold power. And for me, it's about resistance and awareness. This is the only way that we can move forward. And to see, for example, all of this young generation of activists, environmental activists, in the millions, the street demonstrations that are happening.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, now government is mocking them and making fun of them, but ultimately these are going to be the future leaders. This is the power that's going to happen. They're going to be in these positions. And so for me, like, honestly, I don't know if I can convince any political leader now to let go of power for the sake of love and humanity. It could happen. I mean, it will be great if it happens. But I think what we need to do is to pull power away from them through resistance, through activism, creating the alternative models for them, and to educate the next generation on the core issues of peace and healing and love and reconciliation and taking care of the environment. It has to be a generational issue. That's the only way. So
yeah, and I have to say, I'm in fact really shocked when I think where we were in the 70s and in the 80s, where things looked like becoming more sane in a way. It was an illusion, of course, I see now. But at that time, we were really in this hope also, in this strong energy that things can be changed and walls come down and we will not build up more walls. And what I see now is more really this move in going down and up and going down again at this very moment. And of course, it can also go up again. So my hope is there that we will really learn and become wiser. We just have become wiser as a species. We will not survive if we don't do it. So it's the alarm clock is ringing.
Yeah.
But there is this beautiful poem, song from Leonard Cohen, "Ring the Bells," that still can ring. And so we really have to ring it, I think.
So for me, Zen is a way that emphasizes an experience of that oneness of life. And it tries to come up with different techniques to help you experience that oneness of life.
Technology and economy were defining the concept of development until now. Which other references have to be considered to change this concept deeply of what is development?
It depends how it is used, I think. If we really use technology for the benefit of the human race and of course of the whole environment and all, if we use our intelligence to the benefit of for all and not only for profit, there is something very good in it, I think. But if we use it to destroy the enemy, the ones who is always somewhere, then we just miss the opportunity to use our intelligence in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, there is so much happening, advancement in green technology and fair technology and in the using solar energy. I mean, there is amazing research that's happening, and it's been wonderful to see inventors or communities that are engaging in this work that are insisting that whatever they create will be a gift to the world. So to use information technology, to use the internet to spread their knowledge of new inventions that they're creating using solar and wind energy and how to take care of the water and agricultural systems. And they refuse to bow down to the capitalists, to the money makers. And there are many, many examples of this around the world. But it's going to be a challenge because, again, we're so embedded. You know, capitalism is not just a concept. I feel like sometimes capitalism has become part of our skin, like it's really embedded in us, and there's a lot of unlearning that we need to do and to create space for new systems to begin to emerge. So even when we use the word economics, what do we mean by this? Like, well, yes. what is a system? It's not about economics, it's about how can we make sure that everybody's needs are being met. It's not about having more money or less money, even maybe the concept of money we have to think about again, to really return to, everybody's needs should be met in this world and to be able to live here.
Yeah.
And so to use technology to achieve this has been amazing to see in Africa. So a lot of new inventions are being done by Africans themselves when it comes to solar energy and water retention and using technology there. And if people just need to be given the space. Again, the problem is the system. The system does not allow for it. If they control the seeds of rice and corn that we eat, and they destroy any farmer or community that is trying to maintain seeds, this is how controlling the system is.
Yes.
But, this is the fight, I think.
These issues are big, yeah. Yeah, I think it would be so important to hear much more, to really support all these platforms who really offer all these beautiful ideas and films and information on all different levels of which are possible. Because we need that. We need that as a seed of hope, and we need really to support them. It's very, very important. So, so that we can value life again.
Yeah. Not everything
in
is
all
bad.
Different forms. Of course not. Of course not.
Yeah, there's a lot of good.
It's so beautiful.
Happening.
Yeah. Very, very much.
Find
and beauty.
What perspective do you see for an ending conflict between Palestine and Israel?
Yeah, for me, if I wasn't hopeful, I wouldn't be doing what I do. So I really believe that the conflict occupation will end. What I'm interested in is not just to end it by both sides reaching a political agreement that creates separation between them and builds more borders. And so for me, my hope is that we can actually end this conflict by really addressing the core issues of why this conflict exists. And going back to what we've been sharing, the biggest main reason why we live in conflict is because of fear and trauma. This is not a religious conflict between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. They have lived in peace for many, many centuries. This is not a conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. This is not a conflict between cultures and tribes. This is a conflict that, for me, is embedded in the fear and the trauma of the communities that live in this land. Traumas that have been created because of how we treated each other, but also traumas that we inherited. And you referred to the Holocaust and Auschwitz. Auschwitz reshaped Jewish identity in a way where mistrust and fear of other communities became the main lens in how Jews perceive the world. And for me, this is healing. And so for me, a big part of the work that we do is in healing and transformation and nonviolence. We need to resist the structures that create oppression. We need to build leadership that is transformative, that is big, able to create a vision from the future, not from the past. And when it comes to the past, we need to heal it. And then for me, this is the hope for the situation in the Holy Land. And ultimately, it goes back to the question of human rights. That once we begin to recognize the full right of all the people to live in dignity and respect and in honor and in security in the land, that means the things that they need for their security being provided for them, not security in terms of weapons and walls, but to live as a secure family, as a secure community, then we will find peace. So peace work for me is creating the foundation, not the political blueprint.
Yeah.
That can be one state, two states, 10 states, or a whole new system when the whole nation state system collapses.
Yeah.
But if we have the foundation, then it doesn't matter what the system is.
Yeah.
We will be able to live in peace.
Yeah, this is the only opportunity to heal the past. So first we have really to acknowledge it, what happens to us and what we feel and where we are traumatized in ourselves. And of course, both of these civilizations are highly traumatized. We experienced that in our retreats in Auschwitz, and we do that when we do these bearing witness retreats in Auschwitz. We have, of course, survivors sometimes, now they are very old, from the camps, but we have also the children and grandchildren from the victims of the Holocaust. And we have the traumatized children and grandchildren from the perpetrators. Mm. And we brought also always Palestinians now since many years to the retreat. And what we experience is really that when we meet in small circles and when we have the time and when we are able to sit there and to listen to the stories of each other, we just learn that suffering is suffering if you are a child of a perpetrator or if you are a child of a victim who died there, or a grandchild, that it is just deep, deep suffering, and that we have to share about the suffering first, and that we then find ourselves in friendship. It's really about having a place to open up to our pain and fear, to find our shared humanity again, and then this will be the start to think about how can we live in peace, how can we support each other. I also think it's a long way because it is so individual in a way. It is the only way to listen. It's really, we have to listen to each other and to try to go on in the best way we can.
And now for you, Barbara, what role do you see for Switzerland as a neutral country to change things for more peace in the world?
Yeah, we would have such a great chance to be much more powerful, I think, in that. In Switzerland, we have, we speak four languages. So our legal papers are all offered in four languages, and Switzerland is so small, and there is a lot of diversity still. And we learned to live quite peacefully together. And because we were poor, so we didn't have resources, of course, we also found very smart ways to get richer. But it would be very, very good if we would follow the ethical rules we have in the vision of Switzerland, and which we quite are living in a good way in the country, living together, but having more focus on that also, our role in Switzerland as a state to be the place of peace. Even be stronger. Even we have, of course, Geneva. We people come, they meet here, they have conferences, and we say that the Swiss people are very generous in donation, giving donations outside. But really, to stop selling weapons would be very important, I think. And I think we really have the responsibility to do that because we didn't have to suffer under two world wars, and where the others had to. We could build peace schools much more, also be very clear with our ethical vision and spread that out. And I also think we should also be in the EU to have a voice there and to bring our values to the EU. So I'm for that. We can't just still behind staying behind the mountains and enjoy our beautiful life here. And we have really a responsible to give also back to the world what we learned in this long time of freedom, living together in diversity.
We are coming to the end. Only two questions more. This question for both. Can you both share with us what are your upcoming projects for next year? What are you planning as peacemakers now?
Yeah, for me, this coming year is going to be a big year of transition. I am stepping down from the position of the director of the organization and focusing on the programs. And for me, that means to reconnect more with the grassroots, to work with communities, to engage in deeper work when it comes to trauma and the healing, and not just in Palestine and Israel, but to look at this also as something global. You know, fear is a global epidemic. It is not just what is happening in one country or one area in this world. And so for me, the transition will be to do the work locally, but also to engage in work globally as well. And there will be a lot of focus on issues of environmental justice and working together with Palestinians, Israelis, and the international community to address the global crisis that we are having when it comes to what is happening to our beautiful Earth. So this is going to be a big transition year for me. And I would say that for me to bring it all back to the focus on creating the new consciousness. And I think it's going to take many of us that are engaging in this work from a consciousness of love and unconditional love to all humans and to all things. Peace work cannot happen from fear. It has to be coming from love. This is the only option that we have to address fear, is by doing this work that we do from love and completely not living in any fear, no matter what.
This is a wonderful word. Of course, yes, I also think, and it is a basic of all the religions also, I think, and
yeah.
Was the basic.
Yeah.
So, and the wish, yeah, sure. I try to support peacemakers around the world in their beautiful work, and they do so many different things, like they have projects for environment, and they do meditation with people, and they have projects in the prisons with people who have really a bad life there, and a lot of work with refugees and all of that. And we will have again one of the retreat in Auschwitz. They are going on since 23 years now, where a lot of diverse people will meet, and we will have a retreat together.
Exactly.
Which I look very much forward.
Yes.
In Israel, Palestine, with your support, Sami, and with peace engaged people, peacemakers in Israel. So I'm really looking forward also for that, to be there in our with our three tenets that we have, like being there with an open mind, in not knowing, without having fixed ideas at the start when we meet the different voices, and then bearing witness to each other and really listening deeply, and then share and look what we can do to each other and how we can support each other, and so the peace process in Palestine and Israel. This is what we do.
Exactly.
Day by day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thank you so much.
And the last question is, last but not least, what would you like to leave as a message for the new generation who has to struggle with this heritage?
See the beauty of the world, enjoy it, and support each other to hold it safe.
Beautiful message. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add, and it's what you're saying, is don't be stuck in the past. Look towards the future. You are the future generation. You are going to make it happen. All our parents have done mistakes, but they have all tried their best.
Yes.
And this is who they were, and in the consciousness that existed. And this next generation is going to be with a new consciousness, or a more developed consciousness than what we had.
Mm.
And they're going to be able to achieve much more. And so never lose hope. Look towards the future and come engaging from a place of love.
Yes, and they have. We have also to tell them that they have all the peacemakers throughout all space and time in their back and supporting them. They are not alone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Sami. Good, all good friend.
Always,
so good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Is there anything else you want to say.
Thank you, Sabine. It was really, you raised good questions.
I don't think I've been ever in an interview like this.
She was really thinking about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope it was good for you.
I think so. I hope that the technology will help us and it's all okay because...
Thank you, Nicola, for sustain us with your smile.
It was good. Yeah.
Good. I've made a vow to try to bring to help as many people as possible realize the interconnectedness of life. And that's what drives me. And I think by doing that, that reduces suffering. I don't believe that there's an end to suffering. I don't believe in utopias. I don't believe we can fix anything. But I do believe we can move things in a good direction to reduce suffering.